Divorce him? Of course I never divorced him. I was only 14, for God's sake. It couldn't have been legal. Holly tapped an empty martini glass. Two more, my darling, Mr. Bell. Joe Bell, in whose bar we were sitting, accepted the order reluctantly. You're rocking the boat kinda early, he complained, crunching on a Tums. It was not yet noon, according to the black mahogany clock behind the bar, and he'd already served us three rounds.
But it's Sunday, Mr. Bell. Clocks are slow on Sunday. Besides, I haven't been to bed yet, she told him, and confided to me. Not to sleep.
She blushed and glanced away guiltily. For the first time since I'd known her, she seemed to feel a need to justify herself.
Well, I had to. Doc really loves me, you know, and I love him. He may have looked old and tacky to you, but you don't know the sweetness of him, the confidence he can give to birds and brats and fragile things like that. Anyone who ever gave you confidence, you owe them a lot. I've always remembered Doc in my prayers. Please stop smirking, she demanded, stabbing out a cigarette. I do say my prayers.
I'm not smirking, I'm smiling. You're the most amazing person.
I suppose I am, she said,
and her face, wan, rather bruised-looking in the morning light, brightened. She smoothed her tousled hair, and the colors of it glimmered like a shampoo advertisement.
I must look fierce, but who wouldn't? We spent the rest of the night roaming around in a bus station. Right up to the last minute, Doc thought I was going to go with him, even though I kept telling him, but Doc, I'm not 14 anymore, and I'm not Lula May. But the terrible part is, and I realized it while we were standing there, I am. I'm still stealing turkey eggs and running through a briar patch. Only now I call it having the mean reds.
Joe Bell disdainfully settled the fresh martinis in front of us.
Never love a wild thing, Mr. Bell, Holly advised him. That was Doc's mistake. He was always lugging home wild things, a hawk with a hurt wing. One time it was a full-grown bobcat with a broken leg. But you can't give your heart to a wild thing. The more you do, the stronger they get. Until they're strong enough to run into the woods or fly into a tree, then a taller tree, then the sky. That's how you'll end up, Mr. Bell, if you let yourself love a wild thing. You'll end up looking at the sky.
She's drunk, Joe Bell informed me.
Moderately, Holly confessed. But Doc knew what I meant. I explained it to him very carefully, and it was something he could understand. We shook hands and held on to each other, and he wished me luck.
She glanced at the clock.
He must be in the Blue Mountains by now.
What's she talking about? Joe Bell asked me. Holly lifted her martini.
Let's wish the Doc luck, too, she said, touching her glass against mine. Good luck, and believe me, dearest Doc, it's better to look at the sky than live there. Such an empty place, so vague. Just a country where the thunder goes and things disappear.
Trawler marries fourth. I was on a subway somewhere in Brooklyn when I saw that headline. The paper that bannered it belonged to another passenger. The only part of the text that I could read, Rutherford, Rusty Trawler, the millionaire playboy often accused of pro-Nazi sympathies, eloped to Greenwich yesterday with a beautiful... Not that I wanted to read any more. Holly had married him. Well, well. I wished I were under the wheels of the train, but I'd been wishing that before I spotted the headline, for a head full of reasons. I hadn't seen Holly, not really, since our drunken Sunday at Joe Bell's bar. The intervening weeks had given me my own case of the mean reds. First off, I'd been fired from my job, deservedly, and for an amusing misdemeanor too complicated to recount here. Also, my draft board was displaying an uncomfortable interest, and having so recently escaped the regimentation of a small town, the idea of entering another form of disciplined life made me desperate. Between the uncertainty of my draft status and a lack of specific experience, I couldn't seem to find another job. That was what I was doing on a subway in Brooklyn, returning from a discouraging interview with an editor of the now defunct paper, PM. All this, combined with the city heat of the summer, had reduced me to a state of nervous inertia, so I more than half meant it when I wished I were under the wheels of the train. The headline made the desire quite positive. If Holly could marry that absurd fetus, then the army of wrongness rampant in the world might as well march over me. Or, and the question is apparent, was my outrage a little the result of being in love with Holly myself? A little, for I was in love with her, just as I'd once been in love with my mother's elderly colored cook, and a postman who let me follow him on his rounds, and a whole family named McKendrick. That category of love generates jealousy, too. When I reached my station, I bought a paper, and reading the tail end of that sentence, discovered that Rusty's bride was a beautiful cover girl from the Arkansas hills, Miss Margaret Thatcher Fitzhugh Wildwood. Mag! My legs went so limp with relief I took a taxi the rest of the way home. Madame Safia Spinella met me in the hall, wild-eyed and wringing her hands. "Run," she said. "Bring the police. She is killing somebody. Somebody is killing her." It sounded like it, as though tigers were loose in Holly's apartment. A riot of crashing glass, of rippings and fallings and overturned furniture. But there were no quarreling voices inside the uproar, which made it seem unnatural. "Run," shrieked Madame Spinella, pushing me. "Tell the police, murder." I ran, but only upstairs to Holly's door. Pounding on it had one result. The racket subsided, stopped altogether. But pleadings to let me in went unanswered, and my efforts to break down the door merely culminated in a bruised shoulder. Then below I heard Madame Spinella commanding some newcomer to go for the police. "Shut up," she was told, "and get out of my way." It was Jose Ibarra Yeager, looking not at all the smart Brazilian diplomat, but sweaty and frightened. He ordered me out of his way, too, and using his own key, opened the door. "In here, Dr. Goldman," he said, beckoning to a man accompanying him. Since no one prevented me, I followed them into the apartment, which was tremendously wrecked. At last the Christmas tree had been dismantled, very literally, its brown, dry branches sprawled in a welter of torn-up books, broken lamps, and phonograph records. Even the icebox had been emptied, its contents tossed around the room. Raw eggs were sliding down the walls, and in the midst of the debris, Holly's no-name cat was calmly licking a puddle of milk. In the bedroom, the smell of smashed perfume bottles made me gag. I stepped on Holly's dark glasses. They were lying on the floor, the lenses already shattered, the frames cracked in half. Perhaps that is why Holly, a rigid figure on the bed, stared at Jose so blindly, seemed not to see the doctor, who, testing her pulse, crooned, "You're a tired young lady, very tired. You want to go to sleep, don't you? Sleep." Holly rubbed her forehead, leaving a smear of blood from a cut finger. "Sleep," she said, and whimpered like an exhausted, fretful child. "He's the only one would ever let me hug him on cold nights. I saw a place in Mexico, with horses, by the sea." "With horses by the sea," lullabied the doctor, selecting from his black case a hypodermic. Jose averted his face, queasy at the sight of a needle. "Her sickness is only grief?" he asked, his difficult English leading the question in unintended irony. "She is grieving only?" "Didn't hurt a bit, now did it?" inquired the doctor, smugly dabbing Holly's arm with a scrap of cotton. She came to sufficiently to focus the doctor.
"Everything hurts. Where are my glasses?"
But she didn't need them. Her eyes were closing of their own accord.
"She is only grieving," insisted Jose.
"Please, sir," the doctor was quite short with him, "if you will leave me alone with the patient." Jose withdrew to the front room, where he released his temper on the snooping, tiptoeing presence of Madame Spinella.
"Don't touch me! I'll call the police," she threatened,
as he whipped her to the door with Portuguese oaths. He considered throwing me out, too, or so I surmised from his expression. Instead, he invited me to have a drink. The only unbroken bottle we could find contained dry vermouth.
"I have a worry," he confided. "I have a worry that this should cause scandal, her crashing everything, conducting like a crazy. I must have no public scandal. It is too delicate. My name, my work."
He seemed cheered to learn that I saw no reason for a scandal. Demolishing one's own possessions was, presumably, a private affair.
"It is only a question of grieving," he firmly declared. "When the sadness came, first she throws the drink she is drinking, the bottle, those books, a lamp. Then I am scared. I hurry to bring a doctor."
"But why?" I wanted to know. "Why should she have a fit over Rusty? If I were her, I'd celebrate."
"Rusty?"
I was still carrying my newspaper and showed him the headline.
"Oh, that," he grinned rather scornfully. "They do us a grand favor, Rusty and Mag. We laugh over it. How they think they break our hearts when all the time we want them to run away. I assure you, we were laughing when the sadness came."
His eyes searched the litter on the floor. He picked up a ball of yellow paper.
"This," he said.
It was a telegram from Tulip, Texas. "Received notice young Fred killed in action overseas. Stop. Your husband and children join in the sorrow of our mutual loss. Stop. Letter follows. Love, Doc."